The following lecture on the book of Genesis was held at the Jewish Center on Thursday night, December 1st, 1960. I think that the last time we were here, we began to discuss, I think the last thing we discussed was Maimonides, wasn't it? His theory of the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge, and the difference between the two standards by which one approaches the world, the standard of Tov v'Ra, of good and evil, or the standard of Emes v'Sheker, of truth and falsehood. And I think we tried to explain Maimonides as the difference between a subjective approach and an objective approach to existence and to reality. As I pointed out last week, or as I hinted, the Kabbalah has a completely different approach to all of Gan Eden. And the fact that the whole Kabbalah is based upon the idea not of denying other interpretations that the rabbis give, on the contrary, they affirm all of them. But the Kabbalah maintains that the Torah was given on very many different levels, and that the greater one is, the deeper he can go into an understanding of different levels of the Torah. It's like peeling the Torah from level to level. The deeper you go, the closer you get to the heart of it. So that the Kabbalistic interpretation may offer novel ideas, but in no way is it ever inconsistent, or is it ever meant to be inconsistent or contradictory to the traditional interpretations. In Gan Eden we found there was the Eitz Hadas, what are the two important trees in paradise, or in the Garden of Eden? That's right, the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. The Zohar, which is the source book of Kabbalah, maintains in a very cryptic and brief passage, without explaining it too much, without explaining it almost at all, that the tree of knowledge contains within it, the inner core of the tree of knowledge was called Ilana de Mosa, the tree of death. So that there were three trees, basically. The tree of life, and then the tree of knowledge, which was only the outer shell of the tree of death. Implying that as long as knowledge, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life went together, one together with the other, then one had life and one was able to survive. But once you had a breach, a separation between the Eitz HaChaim and the Eitz HaDa'as, once you separated between the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, then the tree of death would make its appearance from within the tree of knowledge. Now, what that means in Kabbalistic terms is one thing. In Jewish mysticism, it has one particular kind of significance. It refers very, very much so to the nature of man's understanding of God and so on and so forth. But for a modern, relevant meaning, it also means, audience, it also means something. The idea, mind you, that where there is a breach between knowledge and life, their knowledge can become deadly. Of course, at this point, when it comes to applying it to a modern condition, everyone is more or less free to see it in his own light. But I would be inclined to see this Kabbalistic idea as one where knowledge becomes separated to, impervious to, and indifferent to the advancement of life, where knowledge is pursued so completely for its own sake that there is no thought of enhancing life or preserving it. Best example, and I'm trying to avoid being homiletical, but at a very practical level, where a physicist will pursue, or an engineer will pursue, the abstract idea or ideal of developing the most efficient kind of nuclear fission. He doesn't care about life. He's not a fiend, but neither is he a reformer, he tells himself. His job is to be an engineer. His job is to be a nuclear physicist. All he wants to do is produce the best, biggest, and cheapest kind of bomb there can be, that possibly can be done. Now, in and of himself, he's not a bad fellow at all. He simply is pursuing the career which is his. What this idea would tell us is that once the Eitz HaDa'as becomes an end in itself, divorced from the Eitz HaChaim, from the tree of life, then knowledge itself can lead to death. In other words, we have no such thing as a worship of knowledge exclusively. It's true. Judaism is by all means an intellectual, heavily intellectualized religion, or we emphasize it to a much greater extent than other people. With us, knowledge is part of the tradition and the heritage of all our people. It's incumbent upon all our people. Das Elokim, the knowledge of God, the knowledge of Kufos and Mazalos, of geometry, astronomy, the world, people, these are all very important. But knowledge must never be a competitor to man himself. It must always be in the service of man. Knowledge, after all, comes from God. Don't we say that in our prayers, in the Shemon Esrei? The first of the weekday prayers is Atochonein Lodem Das. Wisdom is received from God, and therefore, since wisdom comes from God, it must be put in the service of God. It doesn't mean that you can't become a scientist unless you're going to develop a new electric clock for Shabbos. We're not being naive and that unsophisticated. But it means that in the grand scheme, knowledge must never be perverted, and knowledge can be perverted. We've seen it in our own day. Knowledge can be made to be extremely destructive. When Koheleth says, Yosef Das, Yosef Machol, Solomon, when he says, he who increaseth knowledge increaseth pain, he meant that on a number of levels. First, personally. The more ignorant the person is, the happier he is. It's a fact. I mean, knowledge usually causes more pain. In many ways, if you are a completely unintelligent person, you have no problems, basically. Or you have the problems, but you are blissfully unaware of them. And the more knowledge you have, the more sensitive you become. The more sensitive you become, the more you react. And therefore, the more pain a person has. Some kinds of pain are delicious kinds of pain, too, you know. Certain kinds of sensitivity are very happy and pleasant ones. But the more intelligent a person is, the more sensitive he becomes, the more pain he can be caused. I'm sure that none of us ever agonizes over philosophical problems to a very great extent. Yet, a person who has double the IQ of all of us put together will agonize over such problems, possibly. On the other hand, a person who's walking around with an 85 IQ isn't bothered by things that do bother us, inconsistencies in our lives that may bother us. He isn't bothered by them. He isn't aware of the problem if he has it in the first place. But on another level, the increase of knowledge has increased pain on a worldwide scale. The Eitz HaDa'as has revealed the Ilana Demosa, the tree of death that lies in it. So that because knowledge is independent or not subservient to, not subordinate to, the cause of enhancing the Eitz HaChayim and the tree of life, it may be the way of exposing the tree of death that lies dormant in all knowledge, where knowledge can be power and power can corrupt. Not necessarily, but it can. Now, let me get back to a very practical question. When God tells Adam and Eve, when he tells Adam not to eat of the tree of knowledge, what does he tell him? Where is that? No, I haven't got the page. Well, could someone give me a chumash, please? I can't follow the... Yes, Meitz Adas Tovara Lo Socha Mimenu Ki Biyom Acholcha Mimenu Mos Tamus. That means the tree of knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat, for on the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. Did he? Did he die on the day that he ate of the tree of knowledge?
No, God killed him. He must have died in some sense of the word, at least.
Yes, but I'm asking, true, but it's true that Misa Niknasa Olav, that man became subject to death. He became mortal as a result of the crime of disobedience, of eating the tree of knowledge, or the fruit of the tree of knowledge. But God says specifically, Ki biyom acholcha mimenu, on the day that you eat of the tree of knowledge, you will die. Do we find that he died on that same day? No, on the contrary, he lives on for several hundred years. He lives to a very, very ripe old age. How many years is it? About 930, something like this? That's not It's not dying a young man. And God had told him, "Ki biyom achol chimenu mos tamus," that he will die on the very same day. What happened? Why was he spared so long? Well, there are a number of answers to it. Well, no, that's not an excuse for not dying the same day.
After repentance, he seemed to be very much sorry.
There was a repentance by Adam. There was repentance. There was tshuva. That's true.
And perhaps because of the sin of folly, much more so than a sin of evil intent.
Well, this was not a sin of folly.
Was not?
Was it? He knew what he was doing.
Childish, I should say, rather than malicious.
Well, that's different. But he knew that he was doing wrong. He may be childish in the sense of being unsophisticated and falling prey to eating, which is a crime that anyone should be able to control. But then again, even the most mature and intelligent adults commit the folly of eating, even when it isn't a religious crime, but a health crime, and we go ahead and do it. So that it's childish only because the Torah paints the picture in, pastoral terms almost. But universally, the crime has been done. It's a picture of universal man, don't forget. God tells him he's going to die. Why doesn't he die that same day? The answer is, and here we find a very interesting relation to something else. The answer is that God here enunciates the harshest kind of punishment that can come to him in order to warn him away from it. God has the choice, therefore, of giving him the punishment. He has the choice of not giving him the punishment, too. Now, mind you, Ki biyom acholcha bimenu mos tamus doesn't mean thou shalt surely die, as it was translated by the people engaged by King James. It means Ki biyom acholcha bimenu, then the day that you eat of it, mos tamus, there shall be legislated the punishment that you shall die. In other words, mos tamus is the death verdict. On the day that you eat from it, you will be subject to the penalty of death. It may come that day, it may come a year later, it may come 100 years later. The idea of death will come on that day.
Why does it then have to stress the word day? Because the word day then is appropriate.
No, because the word day means the moment of. The word day is not to be taken literally necessarily as that moment.
But it's not needed at all.
No, but how then would he express to him the fact that the mortality that what has been given to him would be the result of his eating it? It's simply an expression, in other words. Ki biyom acholcha mimenu. What's that? Yes, this would make it too direct. He wants to say the ki biyom acholcha, that on the contrary, the word biyom is used to stress that it can be that same day. I'm not saying that God that the point was that it could not be that same day. It can be that same day. Now, why does God warn him of the most severe interpretation of punishment? The answer is, this is the way of the whole Torah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
But, if God tells me when you eat of it, you're going to become mortal.
Yes.
But
yes.
It seems to me that he doesn't have any knowledge of death, and it wouldn't be a frightening punishment for him.
Well, I don't know about that.
God says you'll die. You will.
I don't know. Death. I might have thought the same thing too, from a purely theoretical point of view. But those who have young children or had young children realize, but when a child is about 4 years old, they suddenly, out of the clear blue sky, begin talking about death. I mean, I wouldn't have known it until a year ago, let's say. I'm amazed by it. I don't know where they get it from. But evidently, the awareness of man's finiteness is not a philosophical proposition, nor is it only experiential. It seems to be inborn. Children inquire about it, and they're fascinated by the whole thing. They want to know about it. It's not morbid yet, but they know about it, and they're afraid of it already.
I think they've heard it from someone, and that's why they repeat it. I'm sure it didn't just enter their mind from nowhere.
Well, yes, they've heard the word, but the whole concept seems to... the word conjures up things. In other words, if they heard the word die, they would say, what does it mean to die? But they don't say, what does it mean? They don't inquire. I'm speaking now, if it were a second child, a third child I had in mind, I would understand. First one went to school, brought it back, and so on. But I have asked others, and other parents have told me the same thing. Children at a certain age naturally begin to be aware of the end of things. even without having specifically heard about any one person dying. In the beginning, it's a more or less objective thinking, you know, death. Then it becomes very personal and very morbid, so that the awareness of the end perhaps is a part of the psychological baggage all of us take along at birth. How we use it, how we shape it, of course, that depends upon the intelligent training we get or the unintelligent training we get. It can either become morbid to the extent that we dread it and live it and fear it and see it, and ultimately when we're adults to the point where we deny it, and in modern society very often has a tendency to do, in certain levels. You make it so pretty that you in a measure deny it, which is also a form of inverted morbidity, you know. You're so afraid, it's so morbid to you that you have to put a green blanket over it, not look at it. If you have a healthier attitude, then you accept it as part of life, and therefore you don't have to have all the modern contraptions that make certain people very wealthy.
Why do we assume originally that man was immortal before he could? Why can't we assume that he was just like every other living organism and that he would necessarily die? However, this would be hastened by the fact that he ate the fruit. It would seem that the only reason we are interpreting it that way is because God didn't kill him on that day.
Perhaps you're right. In other words, if you maintain that man was never meant to be immortal, you certainly would not be propounding any heresy. The great weight of Jewish tradition, and this does not, again, make it absolutely authoritative, but the great weight of Jewish tradition maintains that Adam was intended to be immortal. If what was the case?
That you were sure to die.
Yes.
Yeah. Said this at all.
You see, that's right, Jerry. If we take it your way, that man would have been mortal anyway, then you have a question. Then you say, well, if it's Biyom HaKocha, if it's the same day, then why wasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly why we do interpret that he's immortal.
No, it isn't because of this. It isn't well, see, the rabbis had another answer, basically. The rabbi's answer was that he did tshuva.
Well, if God had killed him on that day,
yes,
he would have no reason to assume that he was supposed to have been immortal.
That's right. But because he didn't,
reason that God didn't carry out what he supposed
you still have the possibility, logically, yes. But that isn't the reason they said it. Perhaps I would assume that the reason they assumed the immortality of man originally was because he was so different, or that although he was natural, he was also different from other forms of nature. He had a tzelem elokim. Or, further, the rabbis generally assumed, and without any morbidity, that death itself is an evil, a great evil. If it were merely natural, and nothing but natural, then it would not be regarded as an evil. But the rabbis regarded death as the supreme evil
untimely
of the world.
Death,
what's that?
Untimely death.
Any death. And I'll tell you, I don't want to get into this, but let me go one step further to prove that you may be wrong. Do you remember when God curses the man? What is the curse to man?
120 years.
No, that's later on. Chapter 3, verse 27. Arura ha'adama ba'avorecha. Cursed be the earth because of you. Perhaps according to this reasoning, the curse of the earth meant that mortality would now become an inevitable part of nature. But that it was not originally so. No, that's one thing. But I don't know how Dama Bavorecha is also a part of a curse.
Right. That's why you would have to work by the sweat of this crowd, because the earth wouldn't produce its...
Yes, because whatever would happen, because there would be a natural mortality. In other words, I would assume that I don't know how Dama Bavorecha means in addition to the earth not yielding its produce for man, the earth is itself corrupted. And you know why I say that? Because in the messianic visions of Isaiah, you find that there's a vision of nature coming to its best, where the lamb shall lie down with the wolf and the lion with the child and so on and so forth. It would seem to be a vision that harks back to the Garden of Eden.
Actually, though, if man was to live forever,
yeah,
there would be no reason for rule or good.
Perhaps, but maybe not. I mean, maybe... Maybe God wanted the earth to be populated by others other than Adam and Eve alone. But you see, the idea of death does express itself here. Originally, man was not subject to death. Now, why do the rabbi? What kind of proof can you give me that the rabbis regarded death as an evil? You know that not all religious people did. Catholics, for instance, at certain periods regarded death as the great release. I remember in my second year of French in college, we had a poem by, I think it was Lamartine, if any of you are still taking college French. Remember a poem? It's in all the anthologies. It goes something like this. The first lines anyway. Je te salue, ô mort, libérateur céleste. I salute you, O death, celestial liberator. Well, he felt himself bound by earthly chains to this mundane scene where of dishonesty and so on and so forth. And death was going to liberate him, bring him into paradise. So death wasn't bad at all. Death was a wonderful thing. But do we regard it as wonderful? And prove to me that we don't.
Condemn people to death.
Very good. Very logical. What else?
The anecdote about the story of Abu, the hiding the children at the Shabbos.
Yes, well, that's return. That softens the blow.
Yeah, but it
wasn't the story of Buria.
She didn't want to tell him on Shabbos.
Yes, it's a sad occasion, true. But besides all this, what is one of the 13 principles that Maimonides counts? Is there any mention of death in them? In the 13 principles of our faith? What is the last one? Resurrection of the dead, Chiyas HaMeisim. If death is such a good thing, why resurrect people? If you resurrect them, obviously you want to correct something that was done wrong. As a matter of fact, no, not to paradise, nothing of the sort. You're resurrecting to the world. As a matter of fact, this is the way Rabbi Soloveitchik explains the whole theme of Tchiyas HaMeisim, of resurrection. And this is again going off, I didn't want to get into it too much, but just for a few moments. Why is it that we Jews emphasize much more than immortality, which we accept, we emphasize Tchiyas HaMeisim, resurrection of the dead? We're not bothered, incidentally, by the fact that it's a miracle. It really shouldn't bother any logical person for one simple reason. If you believe that there's a God in the world, then creation in the first place of a human being is such an immense miracle that resurrection isn't much more of a miracle. I mean, the growth of a human being from two single cells until you become such a finely divided, intricate, complex machine that thinks and has free will is itself a miracle of no mean proportion. So that resurrection doesn't require much more ability of God. But we're not interested in the natural aspects, the scientific aspects. These are things that are ridiculous to even think about. But the theme in the whole structure of Jewish thought, why did we place any emphasis on Tchiyas HaMeisim? Rabbi Meir says that whoever denies Tchiyas HaMeisim has no share in the world to come. So important is this concept of Tchiyas HaMeisim. If you look more carefully, do we ever mention the belief in Tchiyas HaMeisim in our prayers? Do we? Of course. We mention it more than any other of the 13 principles. In the Shemona Esrei, the third blessing. At least 3 times a day, and Yom Kippur is 4 times. Every single day, 3 times, part of the Shemona Esrei. Baruch Ata Hashem Achaye HaMeisim. Now, is there a Siddur there? Look at any. Alright, look at any Shemona Esrei. For instance, let's take Shacharis. Alright. Now trace the whole blessing after Magen Avraham. Page 54, for instance. Atah Gibor Le'olam Hashem, thou, O Lord, art mighty forever. So what are we beginning to speak about? God's what? Gvura, his might. What does God's might mean? Certainly it doesn't mean his muscular power because he has no muscles. What does it mean then? We'll see in a short while. Mechaye Meisim Atah Rav Lahoshia. You resurrect or quicken the dead. You are mighty to save. So God's might is revealed in the resurrection. Further, Mechal Keil Chayim, what does God do now? We begin to describe God. Mechal Keil Chayim Bechesed, which means that God sustains or supports the living with kindness and grace. Mechayei Meisim Berachamim Rabim, resurrects the dead with great mercy. Somech Noflim, he supports the underdog, the falling. Rofei Cholim, he heals the sick. Matir Asurim, He releases the imprisoned. Mekayem munaso l'sheni afar. He keeps his faith, his word, to those who sleep in the dust, which means those who have passed away. Micha mocha ba'al gvuros, who is like unto thee, he who does mighty acts, gvuros, who can compare to you, O king, who makes dead and makes alive, and who causes salvation to spring forth. You are faithful to quicken or resurrect the dead. Blessed art thou who resurrects the dead. Now, what do you find here? We're speaking about Chiyas HaMesim, and we begin with Gvura, God's might, and we go on to healing the sick, releasing the imprisoned. How does this come to that? And the answer is this. When we speak of God's might, what we actually mean, in the perhaps more sophisticated and less poetic language, is God's ethical character. God's ethical character. Now, what does God's ethical character consist of? In righting the wrongs of the world, in removing the evils of the world. And so we begin the description of removing the evils. What are some of them? Somech nofim, a man is a no-fail. He fails either in business or in prestige or in his life's goals, whatever it might be. God supports him. It's an ethical goal. You increase now. What is the next step? A man is sick. None of us can appreciate health until, of course, we hear of sickness or chalila we experience it. And we realize how important it is to remove this evil. So God is rofei cholim, his ethical character, his gevura. Further, matir asurim, you're imprisoned, you lose your freedom, you lose your liberty. Matir asurim, God releases you. Again, ethical character. Umekayim imunosu l'sheni ofar. But you notice we have skirted around the main issue. We've talked about all kinds of evils. We've talked about being hungry, about being sick, about being in prison, about being a failure, about going bankrupt. We haven't discussed the main evil. What is the main evil of the world? Death. And since God is Baal Gvuros, the acme of might, therefore, he will resurrect the dead too. He will remove the greatest evil of all. So the whole concept of God as the resurrector of the dead is simply the ultimate extension of our belief in God's ethical character. So you see, here you see that belief in Chiyas HaMesim is not some kind of magical superstition which Jews invented because they were afraid of death. Nonsense. This knife cuts both ways. Not that we were afraid of death. It's the same. If you use that psychological attack, you could use it the other way, that those who deny resurrection are afraid of life. The knife cuts two ways. But the reason that Jews believe in Chiyas HaMesim, that we're so receptive to the idea, is that in our conception, God is of the utmost ethical character. And therefore, he will take care not only of minor evils, but of the major evil, which is death. So, all right, hold on. Now we see that, now we can understand or appreciate why Chazal did not put death into the Garden of Eden until man brought it upon himself. Because being the greatest evil, it had no place in creation until it was introduced by man.
You mentioned that the curse of the ground is simply the extension of mortality to the rest of creation.
I venture the idea.
Well, further on it says, Lo sifa kolel o deta damah ba'avu ha'adam.
Where? Noach?
Noach.
Well, yes, God calls a halt with Noach. Noach involves a whole change.
Yes, so this was definitely...
You notice something else with Noach?
Nature's not immortal.
Yes, what page do you have with you? I'll show you in a minute. You notice something else. Even before that, and before God declares a balance in the corruption of nature, and the marble was a corruption of nature, I would say, looking at it both from the biblical point of view and our modern point of view, I would say that it was the last greatest universal cataclysm that we experienced, which is the flood of the entire theretofore civilized world. But you notice that right before then, something very interesting, I just noticed it recently. People realized that the world was cursed. Look at page 8, verse 29. Why was Noah called Noah? Do you know that? And they called his name Noah, Lemor, saying, Zeh yenachameinu, from the word nachem, to console. This one shall console or comfort us concerning our work in the toil of our hands, because of the ground which the Lord hath cursed. So that they were intensely aware of the fact that nature was under a curse. And they hoped that Noah somehow...
But Bavu Bur Ha'adam, that's the stress. That it was simply because of man.
Yes.
Not mankind. I don't think it refers to mankind. It refers to man.
Well, don't forget that, but the first man was not only an individual. He was also a universal man.
Well,
the progenitor.
This is just a projection.
Of more than a projection. Then why should we suffer death because of him?
True.
But you see that his children die too.
No, but that's only again if we assume that he was immortal in the first place. You see, this is
yes.
It all is simply based on this assumption that man originally was immortal and therefore
yeah.
come up with all this, but it can be most easily explained otherwise.
Well, how would you explain it then?
That the ground was cursed simply because man was bad and it was cursed for him. And then afterwards, God regrets cursing the ground and he says,
Does it mean that? Well, but you're insisting that Adam means here only this particular individual. Then why kiyetsa leiv Adam ram in Arab means?
Right.
But Adam is long since dead already.
Yes. No. Yeah. That's right.
Then why should he? Why should God be concerned about his adolescence?
He had cursed the ground for Adam because Adam was tilling the ground along with other people.
But he was dead already.
Yeah, and Noah, he died just before Noah was born.
Yeah, but you're talking about after the flood.
Right.
And after the flood, Adam had been dead.
Yeah, and that's why you could say that he was named Noah, because he then was to usher in the age which would...
Agreed. But after the flood, God says, no more Mabel.
Yeah.
Now, if your theory is right, then God should have said, no more Mabel, because Adam is dead, his sin has been paid for, goodbye.
No, that had nothing to do with it. No more cursing the ground.
No more curse. So it should have been, but the reason should not have been that evil is intrinsic to man, which we'll have the chance to discuss later, but rather that man had paid for his crime because this man called Adam was dead, finished, the crime is done. That would have been the logical thing. Man, Adam is dead, gone. But instead the Torah gives a different reason, which shows you that the whole drama of Adam is a universal human drama. Ki yetzer leiv ha'adam ra min urav means every person has a natural propensity for evil. It doesn't mean original sin, mind you. But it does mean, as Heschel points out, original sinfulness. We don't believe that one sin means that every man begins with a fall, every man begins with a tainted soul. But every man does begin with a capacity for a sin as well as a capacity for good.
Since we don't have the doctrine of original sin,
yeah.
why should we still have the punishment of someone who had... We're continuing the punishment of
mm-hmm.
someone without his sin, no?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. Well, put it this way, perhaps. Chazal also say that Ein Adam Meis Ela Becheto, no man dies unless he sins. In other words, no human being dies unless he sins. We're speaking of adults, naturally. Of course, it doesn't refer to children, but this is a separate case. No adult dies unless he sins, by which we mean, naturally, that there is no human being in the world who doesn't sin. We have no human being whom we believe is completely taintless. There is no such person. And every person dies because of a sin. Of course, you know that in the scale of merit, a small thing for us to a tzaddik would be regarded as a major crime. At the same time, you may say a wrong word to a person and have deep pangs of conscience, but to a mass murderer, this will not bother him at all. So that the idea of sin is, of course, at all times a subjective as well as an objective matter. It depends not only on the crime that was committed objectively, but on the person who perpetrated the crime. So that we would say that man's original sinfulness, which he inherited from Adam, brings to him the punishment he inherited from Adam. That would be a way of getting around it. Actually, it's a good question. I don't have all the answers. I'm sorry. Well, let me get this question first. Yes, sir.
Like practically everyone about it here, I have seemingly a thousand questions that no man can answer, but I'll ask just one. Why should man or any other person inherit either sin? Should inherit anything like that? Why should he be unlike a clean slate, as it were? If, Adam had no, did not have a passage to sin when he was created.
Oh, yes, he did.
Uh-huh. Well...
Oh, yeah, no, you're getting me wrong. I'm not saying that man inherits a sin.
No, he
inherits a sin. Our first prayer in the morning is, Elohai neshama shenasata bi tahorahi. The soul you gave me is clean. It's not tainted with original sin.
But it is, however, tainted to the extent that original sinfulness...
Yes, that means that the human being, by his very nature, because he has... If man didn't have the capacity to sin, he wouldn't have free will.
True. But the point is that a person, a baby born, is, well, except for his years, he is as clean a slate as Adam. Yet Adam was created immortal, and the baby is created quite mortal indeed. Why?
Well, I'm telling you, you're simply rephrasing the question. But let me just point out one small thing. In this post-Freudian era, we no longer point to a baby as being completely free and clean. Babies have their own sins according to modern psychology, whether you accept it or not. But the question is there. I mean, the question is there. Now, I can revert back to the theory previously propounded if you say again, as Jerry does, and here I'm simply discussing the problem with you, I haven't got the final answer, that sin, that death was inherent, but it simply was declared to come at an earlier time for Adam because of his sin, then that would answer your question.
But does that mean that Adam's descendants were doomed to die at some time or not at
life? Yes, because it's part of their nature. If you accept the other theory, I'm not willing to accept it yet. The fact that I have a question means I haven't studied it, but I want to look into it.
I have another question, which will not lead us too far astray, and can be answered simply, I think. When Adam was ejected from the garden, I presume he left the garden with the animal life still in it and found yet a new sort, an outside world, also with animal and plant life in it, but for some reason with no human life in it.
Oh, I don't know about that.
In other words, there may have been people...
The Torah tells us only significant narrative. There's a basic question, you know. Cain and Abel had children.
They might have done it by incest. It would not have been...
But we didn't hear about any sisters being born.
Whoops. They might have... I don't know. I can't answer.
They couldn't have done it by themselves. Well, so there must have been other people created. Huh? Well, no, well, yes, but he means Eve. I thought he meant sin. You know why I refer to this? I refer to the question because one of the answers given by the Agada is that they were born with twin sisters, and the world began with an act of incest. But our rabbis have long maintained that after Adam was created, there were many other creations. Adam wasn't the only man.
Maybe there were other people created.
Of course, of course. Well, afterwards.
Not
necessarily at the very same moment, but afterwards there were other creations.
In other words, Adam and Eve were created, and other people were created. Was that before or after Adam and Eve were ejected from the Garden of Eden?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's not a... I mean, these are things you can't investigate and know very closely. We have no chronology about it. The Midrash has many theories. One of them was that... there was another woman who was created in addition to Chava, and he had children from her, and Lilith she was called. And I mean, but these are things of conjecture. I mean, you see, I prefer to stay to the basic principles, the universal principles we can learn from this. Those questions can go pretty much. Let me ask just Jay, Richard, you had a question. Okay. Let me try to go further. I was about to say something. Now, if we go back and take the biyom achol chamimenu, the day that you eat from it, and that later God, when God came to punishment, God did not exercise the punishment of the same day. He rather softened the midas hadin with the midas harachamim. He softened the punishment by giving him a sort of suspended sentence, or not in the technical language, but he suspended the sentence for a while. He exercised midas harachamim. I would like to point out that the same idea of setting a very strict punishment in principle and in practice of making it more lenient seems to run all through Judaism. An example. You often have in the Torah the the threat of capital punishment. Do you often find it invoked and used? Very rarely. As a matter of fact, in the Torah, both the oral law and the written law, the total number of cases of capital punishment is still less than England or France had as little as 100 years ago, which is a remarkable commentary on the Torah's leniency in punishment, even in principle. In practice, in actual reality, it was extremely rare for capital punishment to be effected. It was, but very, very rare. First of all, the requirements had to be so absolute and that they were so restrictive that it was unthinkable for a man, let's say, to be executed for murder or for Chilul Shabbos or for adultery. You had two witnesses who were absolutely reliable and valid, who can't be relatives, had to be of impeccable character themselves, had to have told them you can't do that because if you're going to do that, what you have in mind, you'll be violating this and this law for which the punishment is such and such. And he had to say, I realize that and I'm doing it nevertheless. You see this sort of thing was a very rare, it could happen, but it's a very rare situation.
But, if we say that man is immortal and his punishment is ultimately death, then he's getting his punishment, and simply the mercy then of God would be to just postpone it. However, now, with this postponement, he's also getting extra punishment.
What do you mean?
This would not be mercy.
What do you mean?
Not only is he dying, but he's also having to work by the sweat of his brow. His wife is going to have to...
Oh, yes. Well, his wife is separate. His wife had her own...
Well, the same punishment applies to her.
Yes, you see, you're right.
So then why does it seem not to be murder, but it seems to be an extra?
No, but you tell a man, let's say, that I sentence you, he committed a crime, the judge says I'm going to sentence you to death, but instead of imposing the death sentence today, I'm going to impose it 99 years from today.
And now you'll have
hard work. Meanwhile, you go out and earn a living for yourself. Well, I mean, all of us would want to serve out the whole term.
But it would still be a punishment that was uncalled for.
No, well, that's not for us to say. I mean, you see, you have to. The question is it called for or not? Is a matter? How can we judge that? I mean, it's not a matter of fairness in the present conditions. I mean, you're using the wrong perspective for it. You're using the wrong perspective. You see, you're using the perspective of life as it is today, and you're equating the itzavon, let's say, b'zeh asapecha tocha lechem with hard labor in a road gang. It's not exactly equivalent. I mean, it's not exactly equivalent. No, the punishment is that there will be mortality, or put it in one big bundle, life will become harder until it ends. In other words, there's a corruption of the whole fabric of life. It's not just a judgment that a judge calls out and bangs on his gavel, the clerk records it, the next case up. Here is an event of cosmic importance, and the judgment is the corruption of all of life. We'll see later on, if we get a chance, that his whole personality begins to change. According to the rabbis, many things happen to Adam. His personality begins to degenerate. There's a breakdown of the whole man. Not as a punishment that God ordains, but as a natural consequence of sin. Sin becomes a disturbance. It's a spiritual neurosis, sort of equivalent to a mental one. He breaks apart in many ways. Go ahead.
When is the sign of tshuva on his part?
Nowhere is in here, but you find it... that both that Cain did tshuva and later Adam did tshuva. Cain first. Let me go further now. I wanted to discuss with you this mother of all of us, Chava, because just as Adam represents universal man in the whole drama of Gan Eden and the events around it, so Chava represents woman, or womankind as opposed to mankind. Here we're speaking of mankind, not mankind. Now there's a difference where you put the emphasis. When you speak of mankind, you mean humankind. You speak of mankind, you mean as opposed to womankind. Chava represents universal woman, and therefore the Torah's judgment or view of Chava herself. Let's discuss it not only in terms of the written text itself, but also in terms of what Chazal, the rabbis, added. Just a few incidental remarks. Why was Adam put into this tardema, this deep sleep, when Eve was formed? As we refer to it, the anesthesia of antiquity. Chazal say that Thomas says in Sanhedrin, and here's a very remark of great insight. They point out that she would have held very little charm for him had he been fully awake and witnessed God's creation of her from the very beginning. She would have been fully known to him, and that charm very often is allied to mystery and to the unknown. Chalal had a very deep psychological insight. In order to make her more appealing to Adam, so Adam was, God put Adam into a sleep, he should not witness her creation. And therefore, there should always be the element of mystery which serves to attract rather than to repel. The Talmud and Brachos maintains that woman is more complicated physically than man. You all know that according to Jewish tradition, she matures earlier. That's why she reaches majority 1 year before a boy, at 12 years old rather than 13 years old. It's true. It's true in biological and psychological terms. The rabbis maintain that woman was endowed with a special intuition that was not given to man. What is the term the Torah uses for the creation of woman? Do you recall? Yes, Vayiven is at Sela. What page is that? Page 4, is it?
22.
Yes, 4 verse 22. The word, the first word is Vayiven. God built the rib. He translates as formed. Literally, the word means built, but what's the difference? But do you recognize a different Hebrew word from the word Vayiven? What other word do you notice here? By association, if you have a sense for a pun, it should remind you of it. Bina. Bina, which means understanding or intuition. Not only from the word, not only from the word Vayiven he built, but Vayiven he understood. He gave her understanding. So that the very word, what is the word? The word to build, after all, God doesn't build a human being out of a rib as a builder would build a house. It's formed, it's created, or something of the sort. The word is particularly used, said the rabbis, because of the idea that he endowed this tzela, this form of a woman, not only with a physical construction, but also with an additional kind of intelligence, an additional kind of intuition, which probably is a natural requirement for anyone who is going to be in charge of raising other human beings and being a mother. So that the whole idea of Vayiven was used as an idea of additional intuition. Chazal maintained too that woman is more resilient than man. Do you recall, what sedra is it, the last one or the coming one? When we read the story of Yitzchak and Rivka and their two sons, it was last week, 2 weeks ago. Rivka and Yitzchak, husband and wife, what were their two sons' names? Yaakov and Esav. One was the good son, one was the bad son. Did Rivka know the difference between them?
Yes.
Apparently, she knew who was that Yaakov was the good son. She knew that Esav was an incorrigible criminal. But how about Yitzchak? Did he appreciate the difference between them? On the contrary, he was not able to tell the difference between them too much. If you read through the whole story, the whole series of relationships between Yitzchak and Rivka, you find that Yitzchak cracked very quickly. He was very brittle. He was very brittle. Rivka had more bounce to her. She was able to understand it better. She grasped the situation quickly. She maneuvered it quickly. And she knew what she wanted. Yitzchak tried to fool himself until his very last. And he didn't die very happy. He was fooled by his sons and he cracked. He was blind. Whereas with Jacob, with Abraham, with Moses, we read that their greatness was that they died in full command of their faculties. Yitzchak, you had the feeling not of a man who's dying, but a man who's fading, rather. He was weak. Essentially, he is the weakest of the three of us. Do you know what our rabbis say about why the rabbi is speaking about this incident, this comparison of Yitzchak and Rivka, make the comparison to man and woman generally, and they point out that generally, woman is more resilient than man. And do you know how they point it out? what they attributed to in their own midrashic way. What was man created from? Earth. What was woman created from? Bone. Take a vessel made of earth, of clay, and drop it. It shatters to a million pieces. Take one made of bone, it bounces back, and you pick it up again. So they say that woman who was made from tzela is resilient. Man who is made from ofar, clay cheres, is not resilient. Under stress, it tends to crack. And the idea of being able to survive stress is one of the fortunate traits that womankind has that we less fortunate beings don't share. Marriage is obviously intended by the Torah, yes, Jerry.
It's interesting, there were experiments conducted on this subject of stress, and they seriously considering also sending up a woman instead.
Yes, precisely. The thing began with Ashley Montague a couple of years ago when he came out with what was broadly thought to be a big anthropological joke. They thought he was pulling the public's leg, but it turned out he was quite serious about it, and to the point where they now are thinking of a woman as the first astronaut rather than a man. Was that? Yes.
Very scenic description.
Was that?
A
very scenic description.
Yes.
Lovely.
Very good. Now, with regard to marriage, our view is, of course, that celibacy is wrong, and that marriage is the normal state of mankind. Lo tov heyos ha'adam levado. It is not good that man should be alone. First God says it, then man asks for it. Man asks for a mate. You find it here, as I mentioned to you last time, in verse 20. After seeing that all animals, all birds, had their mates, ul'adam lo matzo ezer kenegdo, man did not have a mate. He feels this oppressive loneliness. So that marriage is regarded as a natural state of man, and not as a concession to the weakness of his flesh, as let's say Christianity does. The statement Al Kein Yaza, verse 24 on page 4. Al Kein Yaza Ish Es Aviv Esimo. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, V'davak B'Ishto, cling or cleave unto his wife, V'hayu L'Vasar Echad, and they shall become as one flesh. This, of course, was not written by Adam. I mean, this was written by Moshe Baruch HaKodesh, our rabbis say. It was added as an incidental, a parenthetical remark. There are a number of parenthetical remarks in the Torah. You have it in this coming week, Sedra, with the Gid Hanasha, with the particular vein, the jugular vein that must not be eaten. It's put in as a parenthetical remark from the later description, put into the original description. That when you read the story of Adam, you understand that the man naturally should leave his father and mother and marry and become as one with his wife.
Excuse me, Rabbi.
Yes?
These parenthetical phrases were put in at God's...
Well, of course, command. Of course. But they were put into this particular part as a parenthetical remark. I mean, that's what it actually means, but by Moshe Baruch HaKodesh Amra. You notice that the natural state of man also is monogamous. Only one wife. So that although two wives were permitted, polygamy was permitted later, but the natural state was a single wife. Until later, of course, it fell into disuse, and by the time that Ashkenazic Jewry forbade polygamy, it had been already in disuse some, 1,500 years or 2,000 years. In other words, after 2,000 years of being in disuse, it was officially declared excommunicable. But... Yes.
Could you define that?
Yes, that if a man marries two wives, he's put into cherem, which means he's excommunicated, but which it means that no one may do business with him, no one may talk to him, no one may have anything to do with him at all. He's not permitted as part of the minyan. Cherem is a specific term.
In other words, simply seeing the case of being ostracized?
Precisely. With very, very clearly defined rules applicable to a man. In fact, the whole problem of there are three forms of excommunication in hierarchical value. There is nidui, there is shamta, and there is cherem. Nidui is one day, Shamta is 7 days, Cheirim is a year.
Well, it doesn't have any potential.
Yes, if he doesn't, he isn't convinced by a year's time, it just is renewed. Yes, Cheirim can be for a year or more. Cheirim can be renewed. So can Nidui for that matter, which is the milder form of it. But excommunication is a, you find it in the Torah already.
Mm-hmm.
Find it in Torah. Now, but the original form, the original instinct of man, the original state of man, is a monogamous relationship. Now, let me read to you. V'hoyu levosar echad. They shall be for one flesh. Let me read that Ramban to you. What does it mean that they shall be for one flesh? Rashi says, "Havlad notzar yedei shneihem, v'sham nase besaram echad." The fact that the child is born of both the father and the mother means that through the child, who is one organism, they become as one. So that the oneness of a husband and wife is realized through the progeny. Ramban says, "Ein mizeh tam." Reason doesn't hold up. Why? An animal can do. But why doesn't the Torah say about an animal that should be to one flesh? Obviously, if the Torah says it with regard to man, it must mean something about man that is not shared by animals or by beasts. What is this? Says Ramban, what it seems correct. There is no constancy of a male with a female. Well, to use the modern word, which is I hesitate to use because of the Hollywood connotations to it, but in the deepest sense, love. There is no relationship of love between, all right, we have some animals who do love each other, but I'm not going into that. Generally, you don't, and we can't regard it the same as human love. But with man, the female of the species comes from the same origin as he does. Both come from the same organism to begin with. She was a tzela, a side, a rib of man. Or as we said last time, not actually a rib, but a half of him. Because originally both were one. Man was a hermaphrodite, he was bisexual. Therefore, v'hayu levasar echad means simply to return to the original state. That man and woman should be together as husband and wife means not only that they should look forward to having progeny later, but that they should be with each other psychologically, mentally, emotionally, even as one individual is at peace with himself. Because originally they were both part of the same body. And since this occurred with man, with Adam and Eve, therefore the same capacity, says Ramban, was placed as a natural part of all their offspring. That man and woman should marry and live with each other in a relationship of love. They must always understand and look at each other, not as if there were two different people who were struggling for supremacy, but rather as two people who are basically both part of one being, and so on and so forth. So that Ramban sees here more than just v'hayu levasar echad as a biological fact, he sees it as a very profound psychological fact. Incidentally, speaking about Selah, why did the Torah call the creation of man, why did the Torah refer to it as a rib? Why not a skull bone? Why not an ankle? Why a rib? What's that?
Close to the heart.
You're almost there. You're going in the right direction. Let me read to you what the rabbis say. Lo min haraglayim shelo tehei be'enef kishivcha. The Torah, the God did not create woman from a bone in man's foot, because he should not regard her as a maid servant. Lo min harosh, not from her head. Shelo tehei be'enef kiveres abayas. She should not appear to be his lord and mistress. Avomin Hatzela, Emtza Haguf, but rather from the heart, from the rib, which is the middle of the body, L'shetehe Bebayez Kamozo. They should both share equal status in the home. So that there should be no feeling of superiority or inferiority between husband and wife, but rather to attain the feeling of sameness. And again, the same relationship of which we speak, the relationship not of superior to inferior, but of a tzela. There is an equality of value. It doesn't have to mean equality of function. It doesn't mean that anything you can do, I can do better. But obviously there is no equality of function. It's fairly obvious. But there is equality of value. And this equality of value, the rabbi saw in the particular bone that the Ribbono Shel Olam chose to create him from. You notice, I'm sure you all know this, it's probably unnecessary for me even to point it out to you. When she is created, where is she? Ah, page 4, verse 20. What is his wife called? Ezer Kenegdo, the last two words. For man he hath not found a suitable helpmate, yes? What does Ezer actually mean? A help. Someone to help, someone to live with, someone to be with. Kenegdo means opposite him. So it means how can it be a helpmate opposite him? The two words seem to be antonyms. The expressions seem to conflict. So the rabbis say Zacha, if a man is worthy, then his wife becomes Ezer. Lo Zacha, if he is not worthy, his wife becomes Kenegdo, an opponent. So that whether a wife is Ezer or Kenegdo depends upon a man's scale of merit and his own worth. But the very words themselves are odd, rather. Didn't find an Ezer Kenegdo. It should have been Ezer Lo, a help for him. Is that it's a help against him, because sometimes help, sometimes against, depending on his own deserving qualities. Incidentally, now coming back to what Ramban said before, that v'hayu levasar echad means that they must be viewed as one being, because they have one origin. This has very practical halachic consequences. In the halacha, a man and his wife are treated as one organism, as one being, as one personality. And whatever a wife purchases, let's say, is regarded as a husband's purchase. Anything that the wife does is if the husband did it, and vice versa. They're regarded in the eyes of the law, ishto kegufo. His wife is as himself, as one person.
In the Jewish law, women can contract themselves, contrary to Napoleon.
Well, no, it all depends. It all depends on the marital status, on age, and on the terms of marriage. On the terms of marriage too. In other words, once a woman lives with her husband in the normal way of a husband and wife, then she is not an independent business agent, because we assume she's going to live as a housewife, in which case she does not have independent contractual rights, which would conflict with her husband's independent contractual rights. Unless there is an agreement before the wedding, which you find today very often too, incidentally, there is a swap of privileges. For instance, every marriage involves certain very practical, hard-headed legal consequences too. He has to feed her, she has to do certain services, he has to take care of her, she has inheritance rights. Well, these things we don't talk about, but we know that the law does talk about them. Jewish law does too. Mizonos, Yerusha, Avoda, Metzia. Well, these things have to be discussed. Now, a wife finds something. It belongs to the husband legally. Why? Well, is a wife entitled to food? Can she sue for it? Yes. Well, there's an exchange of privileges. But if they decide at the beginning of marriage, before marriage, not to exchange privileges, then they can decide to do so. He doesn't have to support her, let's say. She's independently wealthy. And then she may retain her independent contractual rights. But this requires a special arrangement. The normal arrangement is that she surrenders her contractual rights for the purpose of being ishto kegufo, of being as one person. And where there is one person, then the law can't have two independent wills acting. You see? So she can exercise the right, but she has to stipulate it specifically. But anyway, the halachic idea of ish, that's why a wife and a husband can't testify against each other in addition to everything else. Well, no close relative can, but especially a husband and wife is regarded as a she'edo ha-karov lo, that this is his wife himself. The question of and I'm just going to this point before I, motherhood we'll discuss next week, but we discussed the Ramban, so I want to tell you what the Abarbanel says. The Abarbanel, in reading through this whole portion of Bereishis, discusses what he regards as his Jewish concept of romantic love. And he finds that there are two kinds he finds in Bereishis. One prior to the sin, and one after the sin. Before the sin, he says, what is the reason for Adam's interest in his wife? What is his first comment? Verse 23. What does man say? Zos hapam etzem me'atzamai uvasar mi'besari. This time it is what? A bone of my bones, a flesh of my flesh. This shall be called woman. Therefore doth a man take leave of his father and mother. In other words, what is the relationship between Adam and his wife based upon? A common origin. Do they require any third party in order to cement their relationship? No. They are by themselves attached to each other. The relationship is highly pure. It's independent. It doesn't require a third agency. Whereas after sin, what happens? Where is it? Page... Page 6, verse 1. The first event after they are driven out of Eden, Va'adam yada es chava ishto, and the man knew Eve, his wife. This knew means, yada means to know. But it means, of course, to refer to marital relationship. In English, we have it too. We speak of carnal knowledge. Because the idea of yada means that the Torah never uses the term yada, let's say, for an animal, wherever that may be discussed. It's purely used as a human term. It's not only a biological term, because the word means more than just a purely physical relationship. It means also a sympathetic relationship.
In
Shemot,
they say the king,
Lo Yada, he didn't know him, didn't want to know him. In other words, to know in a human sense means to sympathize, to feel with, to commiserate with, to have compassion for. So that the there's more than a biological relationship between Adam and Chava, there's also a relationship of Yada. Now, she bears a child, and what does she say? Kanisi ish es Hashem. It's a very difficult expression. She bears Cain, and she calls him Cain from the word Kanisi. I have gotten a man from the Lord. Well, yes, it means bought. Kenya means bought, but it means acquired, to get. Because when you buy something, you get it. Look at those, for instance, when Abraham says of God, he has kone shemayim v'aretz, does it mean that God pays for it in cash? No, it means he acquires it, he owns it. Kanisi ish es Hashem, she means to say, I've gotten a man from the Lord. What does she mean, she's gotten a man? She has a husband. That's right. A third party. She is trying to make up now for the lack of a decent relationship with a husband by having a child. It's a remarkable insight. After sin, not only was there, as I said before, an objective judgment passed down of punishment by God, but the whole life of man underwent a radical transformation, a radical corruption. And therefore, his relationship with Eve also suffered immensely. And whereas before the sin, his relationship of love was retrospective, based upon a common origin, and therefore the two of them were sufficient in and of and by themselves. They didn't have to have anyone else to salvage their relationship. After sin, she has to look forward to having a child to save the marriage. We hear that so often nowadays. Perhaps if they'll have children, things will go well. Well, Adam and Eve, she thought the same thing too. Kanishi issa Hashem. I've gotten a child from the Lord, an ish, a man. Perhaps now we will find prospectively, in the prospect of having a child common to both of us, the common bond to bind us. They had lost the ability to feel for each other in the sense of having a common human origin. So Barbanella sees in this the higher and the lower type of romantic love, one transformed into the other as a result of human sin.
All of this interpretation seems to imply very strongly about the original sin.
Why original sin? Man's sin.
Mankind, therefore, is suffering from what man had done originally.
No, you see, I'll give you an example. The children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, are they going to have an easy time in life getting a job?
No.
No. Does that mean that there is a doctrine of original sin that was somehow passed on to the child? No. But it does mean that parents can make it difficult or easy beforehand for a child. It means that my children are also mine to affect. Whereas I can make no value judgment on them, I can, by living the right kind of life myself, prepare the right kind of background for them to grow into the right kind of people. By leading the wrong kind of life, making the wrong kind of background, I make them the wrong kind of people.
But this is something that
I prejudice them. Yes. Now this begins with the whole story of mankind. The story of mankind begins with a unitary, as a unitary origin. In the unitary origin, once man had done this, then he has created the bad conditions. They can be transcended. It doesn't mean that, mind you, that every case of married love must necessarily be salvaged by a child. We know it isn't so. We know that there are true cases of genuine relationship.
But the very fact that man's present biological and sociological situation is traceable to this would seem to imply that man, original man, had so deceived the man's condition.
Tell me, there is such a thing as cultural causality, just as there is physical causality. Look, our parents, our great-great-great-grandparents valued Torah. The great-great-grandparents of the Germans or the American Indians value the spear and the bow and arrow. Therefore, they are they and we are we. You say that it's not fair? That's the way it is. We suffer because of it and we benefit because of it. In other words, we are determined by our past. That's all there is to it. I mean, it's not a matter of prejudging us. It's not a matter of saying that we cannot be saved except by grace. See, you have to make a great difference here. The Christian says that spiritually we are born corrupt. We say we are born pure into a world that has been corrupted by previous sin. That is a separate thing. I mean, that does not mean original sin. It doesn't say that the heart of man is evil.
The inclination is evil,
but there's also a good inclination. Remember what God tells Cain? He says, "La pesa chatas rovets." Sin crouches at the door, but the atah timshalba, you can rule over him. You're not bound to him. Sinfulness is prevalent, yes. Now, insofar as the world into which we're born into an imperfect world, but we are born with the ability to achieve perfection. We can come close to it. We can control the morally the world in which we live.
Well, as the Christian accepts grace to overcome this, so the Jew accepts Torah.
No. Torah is simply a guide. If I say, I accept Torah, it doesn't mean I'm saved. Whereas if I, well I'm not going to say it, but if I say I accept the belief in so-and-so, then according to Christianity, I'm saved, finished, that's
well,
all.
It's not simply a matter of saving it, it's a matter of
believing it. Or no, I can believe in, you know, there, for instance, Maurice Samuels calls himself, very interestingly, a non-observant Orthodox Jew. He believes in Orthodoxy, full 100%. Doesn't observe it, hardly. Now, does his belief make much of a difference? Well, halachically, you may find some points where it makes a difference, but really, does it make a difference?
No.
Perhaps when he eats a lobster, it wouldn't taste as good because he thinks he has a guilt feeling. But does it make a difference? That, as far as we're concerned, that is just the point. I mean, to say that I believe, well, in Christianity, if I really believe, I have grace. I'm saved from original sin. We have no original sin to be saved from. And if we did have original sin, the mere belief wouldn't help. Which comes back to another major emphasis with us. Belief is simply fundamental from a philosophical point. If I don't believe, why am I doing it? From God's point of view, He wants me to live a certain way rather than to believe in a certain way. Anyway, but you see, the whole problem of The origin of evil in man is not easy, and you see, you can appreciate now how complex it becomes. But mind you, it's Yetzer Lev Adam Raman Urav. Man's inclination is evil from his earliest youth. But he is not a prisoner of evil. He's not bound to it. He can't assert himself. And that's why John Steinbeck's book, East of Eden, which is based upon the words Ve'ata Timshel, he mispronounces it if you read it carefully. In his transliteration, he mispronounces the word Timshel. Timshel, he calls it. But you know, this is a profoundly anti-Christian novel. I mean, a Pauline Christian should be scandalized by it. The critics who did not scream bloody murder probably weren't really good Christians. It was an excellent book, incidentally.
And which lines did he take from these texts?
Pardon?
Which lines did you take?
Well, that's later on. We didn't get there yet.
Next year.
Next year, yes. Someplace on page 6. Where is it? Here, the end of verse 7. The Ata Timshel Bo. Thou canst rule over it, over sin. But you see, when man sins, what he actually does, he invites himself to become sinful more than he was before. Look, all of us live by a biography does not begin anew every day. We are the creatures of our own past. If I, let's say, make a decision to begin smoking again, and I inhale and I smoke regularly, I can't tomorrow as easily decide not to smoke as I can now. And as my decision yesterday influences me today, and my decision today can influence me tomorrow, I always have a residue of a little place for free will, but it becomes more and more constricted as time goes on. Because once I make a decision one way or another way, I'm affected by it. The same thing holds true to the whole history of mankind. My decisions affect my children. And the decisions of Abraham affect me too, as they will for generations to come. There's always an element of freedom, but it expands or contracts depending on the kind of decision we have made. So that in this sense, incidentally, reward and punishment are in the nature of the act themselves. The reward of a mitzvah is to give you the greater capacity for goodness. And the punishment for evil is to restrict the area of freedom and make you more prone towards the evil act. Precisely, aver gorer sever, mitzvah gorer mitzvah. Not merely as a because God ordains it, but because this is the very nature of man psychologically. We affect our own future by that very method.